So Marina, I'm going to talk about a work, joint work with Ellie and Rob, about observational equivalences between causal structures. Ilya mentioned this problem of observational equivalences a little bit in his talk, and now I'm going to delve a bit deeper into it. I changed the title to classical causal structures because I won't have time to talk about the quantum case, but let's see. So I'm going to start by talking about some concrete cases to define what I'm talking about here, and then afterwards I'm going to show you what this classification can do for you. So let's say we have a drug trial and we want to see if our treatment causes recovery or not. But in the first case, suppose that you let people choose if they're going to take the drug or not. So it's not a blind trial, it's just a, people choose. So in this case, there could be some random, like some hidden variables like health awareness, that if the person is more health aware, they're more likely to take the treatment, but they're also more likely to do other things that would cause their recovery. And if I don't assume anything about health awareness, if I don't know anything about it, then in principle, this could explain all of the correlation that I see between treatment and recovery. Therefore, in this case, since I only have passive observations, those two causal structures are indistinguishable. This is what we mean by observationally equivalent. However, if I intervene on one of them, let's suppose I intervene on treatment, that is, I make a blind trial where people cannot choose if they're going to take the drug or not. I'm going to give placebos to half of them and the drug to half of them. In this case, they are distinguishable. If there's still correlation after this intervention, this means that I'm in the second causal explanation, not the first. So if you make an intervention, then those are distinguishable. And it's from those ideas that we have this notion of observational equivalence. And here I'm also going to talk about some definition that we made of interventional equivalence. So taking the same treatment recovery example, but translated to the notation that I'm going to use throughout this talk, observed variables are going to be triangles, and latent variables are going to be circles. So we already know that they are observationally equivalent. But as I mentioned, they are interventionally inequivalent. We can also check other cases. Like here, it was very clear because there you have an arrow between A and B, and here you don't. But what if I'm comparing two structures that are different, but both of them have an arrow between A and B? At first, you might think that they're also observationally equivalent because they can explain any correlation obtained by passive observations. But at first, you might think that they're also interventionally equivalent because when I intervene on A, I could get B. However, the definition that we're going to do here is that they have to reproduce a certain set of observations together with interventions under the same choice of parameters. I'm going to explain what this means. So suppose I go to the lab and I see that when I make only passive observations, A and B are perfectly correlated. But when I intervene on A, they suddenly become completely independent. This means that those two things together, oh, yes.
Just a quick clarification question. You said that when you intervene on A, A and B become independent. But if you intervene on A is not random anymore. It becomes some constant. So what notion of independence are you using here?
Sorry, I just mean that you're going to intervene on A having a value A or a value A prime, and then B is not going to be influenced by that.
When you say intervene, you're just going to, by some external method, set to a new distribution you like. So it's still going to be random, but it's random in the way you control. Is that what you mean? I just don't know what you mean. I have a guess, but is that what you mean? I have a random thing and a fixed thing, and they're independent. If the random thing doesn't depend on the value of the fixed thing anymore?
Yeah, I think so.
Something like that?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. In this case, so in the second graph, this can be achieved because you can imagine that the natural parameters that you have underlying your reality are that both A and B, like B ignores the arrow between that goes from A to it, and both A and B just copy lambda. So in that case, this is achievable there because if they copy lambda observationally, then they are perfectly correlated. But when you intervene on A, now A is not going to depend on lambda anymore. So then A is not going to influence on B because B was ignoring the arrow from A to B anyway. But here, those two things together are not achievable. So this means that those two causal structures are also going to be interventionally inequivalent. All right. But I could have cases where both types of equivalence are true. For example, here, where the second one is just A can directly causally influence B, but it can also causally influence something that is hidden, and this something that is hidden influences B. It's a bit innocuous, so because since A doesn't have parents here, when you make interventions, that's not going to change anything. So they're both observationally and interventionally equivalent. So now I'm just going to define what I mean by those two definitions. So observational equivalence just means that the set of probability distributions obtained by passive observations that are compatible with the two graphs are the same. For this notion of interventional equivalence, I'm going to require this, but more. I'm also going to require that these tuples of the thing that is obtained observationally from a certain choice of parameters, and the thing that is obtained from one type of intervention, another type of intervention. This is actually an infinite tuple because you could have a lot of different interventions in the same node or in different nodes as well. And if the set of such tuples is the same for two different graphs, then I'm going to say that they're interventionally equivalent. And as it turns out, the problem that's hard is the observational equivalence problem. The problem of this interventional equivalence is already solved by this structure that is defined in this paper called an MDAG. So an MDAG is a DAG that respects two things. First, there are no redundant latents. And in fact, every DAG that has a redundant latent is a latent such that their children is a subset of the children of another latent, like lambda here. So there is this, if you assume that the latents can have infinite cardinality, you can just clump them together. So those things are going to be equivalent, both observationally and interventionally. And I'm also going to assume that all of the latents do not have parents. And I can deal only with DAGs where the latents do not have parents because of this exogenization result. Basically, when you have a latent that has parents, it is equivalent to another DAG where the latent doesn't have parents, but instead its parents point to its children, its previous parents point to its children. And because of those two results, I can only look at DAGs that have this structure where all the latents are non-redundant and don't have parents. And DAGs that obey those two things are going to be called MDAGs. And from now on, I'm going to represent them in this way. I'm going to draw only the observed nodes, and then the latent nodes are going to be those loops around the children. So this is very similar to what some people were doing with the bidirected arrows, but the bidirected arrows were like latents pointing to only two observed nodes, but here we have these loops where it can have latents that point to multiple observed nodes. Okay, so we realized that this MDAG structure is enough to completely encode what we know about interventional equivalence. When you have two different MDAGs, they're always going to be interventionally inequivalent. But there are different MDAGs that are observationally equivalent, like those three that I showed in the beginning in the treatment recovery example. And they give you the same distributions if you only have access to passive observations. I made all this argument about interventional equivalence because I wanted to persuade you that those two first rules, the no redundancy and the exogenization, they are somehow more fundamental than the rules that show equivalence between MDAGs, because they also talk about interventional equivalence and not simply about observation equivalence. And being more fundamental, I mean, I'm trying to justify why I'm using the framework of MDAGs here as well. Okay, now before I tell you how do we find out those observational equivalences in general, I'm going to tell you a little bit about why is this important and why this can do for you. So we know that if you have a DAG that is equivalent to some other that is latent free, then it doesn't have any non-trivial inequalities, because for the ones that have latent free, just conditional independence from these separations is enough. And recently, the other way was shown as well. So you have no non-trivial inequalities if and only if you are equivalent to a latent free. So you can see that if you have a full classification of all causal structures into those observational equivalence classes, you can know exactly which ones have non-trivial inequalities and which don't, like which ones are very easy to deal with and which are a bit harder. But as you're going to see later in the talk, even if you don't have the full classification, you can already say some things about the inequalities. But I'm first going to talk about a case that is completely solved. That is the case where your structures have only three observed nodes. So for structures with three observed nodes, Robin Evans shown in this paper that you have 46 total MDAGs, and they can be organized into 8 equivalence classes. So these are, he uses some rules for equivalence that I'm going to discuss later to show that these 46, they're all equivalent to one of these. Inside the classes of the triangle instrumental in Evans, there is no latent free MDAG, but all the others have latent free representatives. But why are these, why do we know that those classes, that those sets of MDAGs are inequivalent to each other? You can use a few different techniques to know that they are inequivalent to each other. For example, if you pick chain and fork and collider, of course, chain and fork has this name because the chain is equivalent to the fork, so both are inside this class. But if you pick them both, you can look simply at the conditional independences that are implied from the separation from them. And you can see that they are different. And even if you make any permutation of the latents, they're going to be different because here you have conditional independence and there you have just a marginal independence. So they have to be observationally inequivalent. But sometimes you can say more than just observational inequivalence. Sometimes you can talk about observational dominance. That it's when the set of probability distribution that is compatible with one DAG is subsumes the set that is compatible with another DAG. So for example, if you look at the instrumental scenario, one of the versions of the instrumental scenario is this one. These two are equivalent. And then it's very clear that it's dominated by the Evans scenario, because the Evans scenario is just this one, but with an extra arrow. So it's at least as powerful in terms of explanatory power. It's still left to prove that they are inequivalent. This just shows dominance. It doesn't show strict dominance. But it happens to be the case. And this is the partial order that holds between those 8 equivalence classes that I showed you before. If you go from top to bottom, you have things that are more powerful to things that are less powerful. Here you have the factorizing one. And what this can do for you? I think this partial order can do a lot of things. First, you can know exactly which ones have and have not inequality constraints. Triangle, Evans, instrumental are the ones that do. And also, if you are looking to solve like the causal compatibility problem, if you have a probability distribution and you want to know if it's compatible, like with which DAGs it is compatible with, you can start from the bottom and go to the top, because if you find out that your distribution is not compatible with, let's say, Evans, then you don't have to check anything that's below it, because it's also not going to be compatible. And in larger cases, this is going to be very useful. All right, but to find such equivalence classes, do we need to a priori know all the compatible distributions and then compare them and then make that partial order? Of course not, because then it would be useless, because then we'll have to solve the hard problem before the easy problem. There are rules that show us that under certain circumstances, two MDAGs are equivalent or inequivalent. And since I already discussed a little bit about the inequivalences in the case of three nodes, I'm going to start from the rules to prove observational inequivalence. When I showed you the example of the chain and fork and the collider, I showed you that if you have different set of deseparation relations between observed nodes, then your DAGs are going to be inequivalent. And so this is one technique to show inequivalence between MDAGs, but it's not the only technique. So right after my talk, Beata is going to talk about inequalities that come from mean separation. And because of that result, we also know that if you have different sets of mean separation relations in two different endings, then they're going to be observationally inequivalent. In this paper, it's also shown that if they have different skeletons, the skeleton is just the undirected version of a directed graph, then they're also going to be inequivalent. And the interesting thing is that those rules are not independent of each other. Actually, E separation subsumes those others. It can show all the inequivalences that those can. In the case of D separation, it's obvious because it's just a special case. We also have some other rules like hypergraph only. That is, if you have an MDAG that is just latents connecting to observed nodes, you don't have arrows between observed nodes, then all of the MDAGs of this kind, they have to be inequivalent to each other. And dense connectedness, that is, in this paper, it shows an explicit property that says that if this property is satisfied, then an explicit distribution is compatible with it. If not, it's not. So you can derive an inequivalence rule from that as well. And finally, we also use this algorithm that is in this paper by T.C. Fraser. That is a very brute force algorithm to find out what are the supports that are compatible with a certain DAG. And as it turns out, if it is the most powerful tool that we have to show inequivalence so far, but it's very computationally expensive, so this is why we also leverage these other tools. And we know that it in principle subsumes E-separation and hypergraph only, if you have as much computational power as you want. Dense connectedness, we don't know in principle. In the cases where we applied, it does subsume, but we still don't know if it's general. Okay, any questions here? All right. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about the rules to prove equivalence. Because in the case of three observed nodes, I black boxed how Robin Evans found those eight equivalence classes. I just said, these are the classes, so let's see what is the partial order between them. And now let's see how these classes are found. How those rules to prove equivalence, what is their shape? So the first one, I'm going to call HLP proposition. It basically says that when you have a node whose parents are the subset of the parents of another node, and they have at least one latent parent, then you can drop the edge between them and you're not going to lose anything. So the intuition behind this is that B knows all of the parents of A. And since they share at least one latent parent, the randomness of A can be absorbed into this latent parent as well. So B knows everything about A. So he doesn't need to, like, he knows the parents and he can know the randomness via the latent variable. So he doesn't need to have a direct arrow between A and B. In this case, they're equivalent. If we go back to our first example of the treatment recovery, this rule shows this side of the equivalence. Of course, we already knew it because it's just saturated, but it's in a special case. Another rule that we have is Evans' proposition that I called split latents for free. That basically here I have the same graph, but instead of dropping the arrow, I'm going to split this latent node in two. In the MDAG notation, we usually don't put a circle around only one edge, only one node, because a latent node that points to only one node is redundant. But here I put it just to make explicit that I'm splitting it. And I'm going to try to explain the intuition behind this one as well. Let's see. First, I drew the same thing, but as a DAG and not an MDAG. And I'll try to justify to you that those two things are equivalent. So if lambda was a quantum system, you can think of A making a measurement on lambda, and this measurement is chosen by the setting of A, that is C. And then because of this measurement, A is going to steer whatever state lambda is going to send to Bob. So this is the same thing as Alice and Alice's setting preparing a state to be sent to Bob. In the classical case, the same thing goes through, but with Bayesian updating instead of steering. So yeah, this is just an intuition on why those two things are equivalent. And then from here, to there, that is the final DAG that we have, is just exogenization. You have a latent that has parents, and then you exogenize it, and you obtain this final graph. And this shows the first of the equivalences between treatment and recovery that we had. Okay. This is a generalization that we found in this work, a slight generalization to this second rule. I'm not going to explain it, but the idea is pretty similar, the steering argument. And this is an example of an equivalence that could not be shown with previous rules, but it can be shown with our generalization. All right, now I'm going to apply these rules. You've already seen, I mentioned to you that for three visible nodes, you have 46 MDAGs in total. Here, I just wanted to show you that the number goes up pretty quickly. Oh, yes?
There's no particular reason to believe this is all of them, right? These rules. This is just some rules you came up with that you were able to prove.
Yes.
But there are probably other ones.
Exactly, yes. There are probably other ones. And I'm going to show you that for the case of four, the problem is not completely solved.
Okay.
So this means that there are probably other ones or, yeah.
Okay.
Maybe not, but I mean, I'm going to explain. Okay, so for the case of three observed nodes, the problem is completely solved. I already showed you. But for the case of four observed nodes, it's exactly this. The problem is not completely solved. We have, from the rules that prove equivalence, we got an upper bound on the number of equivalence classes. And from the rules that prove inequivalence, we got a lower bound. Here, I'm only talking about the number of equivalence classes. Of course, what we ideally want to know is the partial order. And we do have some information about it, but we still don't know how to parse it exactly. So just to show you an example where we still don't know. We still don't know if those three MDAGs are saturated or not. So we don't know if, yes?
So just a quick question about the inequivalence. You include all the nested stuff we kind of found out numerically, right, in that? So we know what's nested equivalent or not for four variables because we just checked. So that means we know.
What do you mean by nested equivalent?
If we just look at the quality constraints of a hidden variable.
Sure.
That we know for four variables.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, here I'm talking about everything.
We have a lower bound for that, right? So mm-hmm. if the things are in different classes, they know they're not the same, even if you ignore inequality. So I'm assuming your lower bound includes that.
Yes, I think it's when I use the deseparation as a method to show inequivalence, then this also includes all of the...
Okay, maybe I'll ask you about it because it's not obvious to me that that's the
okay.
Same. Do you need okay. district factorization before applying the deseparation? Is that?
I see. Yeah, no, maybe not. I don't know. Okay, I'm going to think about it. We'll talk about it later. Anyway, here I just wanted to show one example where we still don't know if they're saturated or not. As I told you, the first method that we have, it gets very computationally expensive if you go to higher cardinalities. So we know that these three are compatible with every support for binary cardinality, but maybe for higher cardinality, no. So this is the reason why we still don't know if our rules are sufficient, and then we just need infinite computational power, or if our rules are not even sufficient. But even if we still don't have a complete characterization, we can already talk about inequality constraints. So every time that we have two graphs, and then here I put this blob that is meant to represent some graphs around it that are also equivalent to it, and we can show that they are inequivalent, but they have the same set of deseparation relations between observed, so we show that they're inequivalent via other method, then we know that at least one of them needs to have inequalities. One example, like very simple example, triangle and saturated. They have the same set of deseparation relations, none. But because of, for example, the only hypergrass rule that I said, they're both only hypergraphs. There are no edges between the visible, so they need to be inequivalent. Therefore, at least one of them has inequalities, obviously the triangle. In the case of four nodes, this can give us new things. And in fact, in the case of three nodes, we know that 3/8 of the classes have inequalities. So it might feel to you that inequality constraints are quite rare. But doing this thing that I showed, in the case of four nodes, 92.6% of the equivalence classes have inequality constraints, at least. And that's because we only saw 25 different deseparation patterns. So this means that at most 25 equivalence classes are going to be inequality free. And I think this is a pretty strong argument as to why you need to work with inequality constraints. Because if you only look at the deseparation relations, you're only going to get it right in a very small percentage of the cases. Okay, now I'm going to tell you about... Oh, do you have a question?
Like it. Yes.
Okay. Now I'm going to tell you about a few other things that we found with this classification. They're were fun, and then I'm going to finish. I think I'm over time.
Yeah, but you're okay for over time.
Okay. Okay. So this is the Bell and DAG. It's just the Bell DAG, but represented as an MDAG. And these are all of the condition independence constraints that are obtained from this DAG between the visible variables. So what we found with this classification is that every other MDAG that has the same set of conditional independencies is equivalent to the Bell DAG. In other words, every inequivalence to the Bell DAG is proved by deseparation between observed nodes alone. So if you have a DAG that has this set of deseparation relations, it's going to be equivalent to the Bell DAG. And this is quite interesting because this DAG doesn't imply only conditional independence constraints. It also implies an inequality constraint, Bell inequality. So if you go to the lab and you observe a probability distribution that has exactly this set of conditional independencies, these and only these, but it violates Bell inequality, then this means that there is no faithful classical causal explanation for this probability distribution. Or classical explanations are all fine-tuned. That's our word for faithfulness. Yeah, that's cool. But, oh, yeah.
Do you know how robust that is?
What do you mean?
But like if you, because you said like if you observed probability distributions in the DAG that have these independence relations, but by robustness I mean what if you also observe some noise? Like for example, when you talk about violation of Bell inequalities, there are usually some robustness bands, right? Like, so like what is the limit of noise that you can, you know, you observe it, but you can still say that, I don't know, Bell
you mean noise as in the probability distribution doesn't exactly obey this
yes.
CI?
Yes, so, like, you observe something that's like very close to this, but not exact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that the best way to think about no fine-tuning is following this more recent work by Rob, where you think of no fine-tuning not as a principle, as like, okay, I observed these conditional independences in the lab and I don't want any fine-tuned explanation, but instead to think about it as an indicator that if your model is fine-tuned, then it's going to overfit the data because it's going to look at these fluctuations that you said that go out of the conditional independencies, and it's going to interpret them as real causal things.
Okay.
So, yeah, but I don't think, yeah. So here I was just saying that it's going to be fine-tuned. I'm not arguing why do we not like fine-tuning, but yeah. Yeah, so something I think even more interesting is that if you look at other causal structure, where you now allow for correlation between S and T, hidden variable that points to S and T, now the conditional independences are those two, and these are no-signaling constraints. This is what physicists call no-signaling constraints, that the conditional independencies, your probability distributions obey those two things. And this graph is also solved by, this equivalence class is also solved by deseparation. And furthermore, it also implies on Bell inequalities. So this means that you don't even need your probability distribution to obey all of those independencies, like S independent of T. If you have a probability distribution that violates Bell inequality, and the conditional independencies are exactly the same, exactly those two, just no signaling, and you don't want any explanation that's fine-tuned, meaning you don't want any explanation that doesn't have those two constraints, then there is no classical explanation for P that you're going to accept. And yeah, this is the result that Rob mentioned before, but I think we kind of see it in a different way here. And what's interesting is that there are other causal structures apart from the Bell diagram. They also have the same property of being solved by this separation. That is, this property that I said, that this equivalence class is the only one that has this deseparation pattern. For example, the square. If you have a probability distribution such that C is independent of B and A is independent of D, and you say, I don't want fine-tuning, then the square is the only explanation for your distribution. If your distribution violates the square, then there's no classical explanation that obeys whatever you want. So just one last thing. These classes that are solved by deseparation are just 18 classes. So I think that's another argument that if you only know the deseparation relations, you only know the conditional independencies of your distribution, and then you want to guess in what equivalence class is your classical explanation, you're only going to get it 100% right in 18 of the cases out of those 300 and something equivalence classes. So it's not a good strategy to ignore inequalities. But still, for these 18 classes, you can have those nice results like that. Yeah. So that's it. If you want me, if you want, I can talk more about the quantum case, but if not, thanks.